Our next guest on the program is a Boston-based journalist. She was a staff writer at Boston Magazine for many years as a part-time resident of Rockport, Maine, and the author of an incredibly compelling new book, Into the Raging Sea, 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of El Faro. Rachel Slade, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me, Rich.
What drew you to the story of the El Faro?
Well, I really, really have been drawn to the sea since I was a little girl. I was born in Baltimore, raised in Philadelphia, lived in New York, now I'm in Boston. These are all port cities. And so I've always wanted to connect to the ocean in some way. And when I read about the sinking of El Faro, of course, like everybody, I wanted to know what happened. How could we lose a modern ship in this day and age? But it also gave me an opportunity to connect with this incredible industry, the shipping industry in America.
Well, you've really done a remarkable job of weaving the story together. And one of the things that really brings the story to life are the voices of those people who were lost on the ship. Thanks to those black box recordings, how invaluable were they to you in telling this tale?
Unbelievable. So first I want to say that this is the longest black box recording in history. It was 26 hours of tape captured, audio captured on the bridge of that ship leading up to the very final moments of the ship. But, you know, I started looking at this story before they recovered the black box. And so already I was drawn in by the people who are on the ship and the families who agreed to talk to me. So already I felt like I was starting to make a connection with those folks. But then when we got that transcript, that 500-page transcript, wow, I just felt like I was on the ship. It was incredible.
Well, and that's the feeling that you get as a reader as well. And there are certainly dramatic moments, but to me, maybe what's most chilling are those mundane conversations that take place on the ship when you know how it's all going to end.
Rich, that is such a good point. That's exactly right, because those are the moments when you realize that you might not have done anything different. Like, those are the moments when you can imagine your coworkers and friends being in that very same position and not being able to find their way out of it and just hoping for the best. Really, that's such a perceptive thing to say.
There were so many things working against the El Faro other than Joaquin, and it starts perhaps with the ship itself, which was quite outdated at the time of it taking off. Was it a 1974 ship?
That's correct, and it was actually designed in the 60s. So it's important to remember not just that this ship was, in order to keep it operational, they actually had to mill their own parts, create their own parts, and they also, you know, pulled parts off the scrap ship. But it's important to remember that the way that ship was built, the way it was designed, would never have been built today. We have changed our standards. We've changed our regulations. We could not have built that ship the way it was built today.
Also, the parent company, Tote, was at the very least ill-prepared. Communication systems, navigation systems certainly were not what they should have been.
I mean, that is definitely part of the story, and as all working men and women in America know, sometimes your company is looking out for you, and sometimes it's not. And in this case, there were many moments when, certainly when I was doing my research, when I felt that the shipping company could have done more to help out their mariners, certainly, you know, upgrading the systems, but very simply, just monitoring the ship. They were not tracking it. There was nobody on land that was tracking that ship and nobody on land that was tracking that storm from the shipping end of things. Although I do have to mention that there was a mariner, an off-duty mariner, Charlie Baird. He was the second mate of El Faro, and he was in South Portland. He was watching that storm develop, and he did reach out to Captain Davidson before they left dock, Jacksonville.
We're talking with Rachel Slade, the author of Into the Raging Sea. You mentioned Captain Davidson, and there's certainly lots of questions about his experience, his ability to handle this situation. And while he's certainly one of the culprits in this story, in many ways, it's also maritime practice and regulation as well, and procedures that seem outdated given the technology that's available in so many walks of life.
That's true. I mean, you know, it's easy to pin all of this on Captain Davidson. And, you know, if you give a quick summary of what happened, it seems like it's all his fault, which is completely unfair. He's as much a victim of circumstance as all of us. I think that he was very concerned about his job security. He had, like all of us who work for a living, he had high expenses. And so he was, I think, very distracted by the pressures being put on him by the shipping company to get those goods through and to deliver things on time.
There are so many wonderful characters in this story. I was constantly drawn to Danielle Randolph, the second mate. She's such a sympathetic character. Did you find yourself in the telling of the story getting close to some of these people?
I mean, I adore Danielle. She was the second mate. She's from Rockland. She was one of two women on the ship, but the only female officer on that ship. And yes, absolutely. I was really moved by her plight. She actually plotted a course that would have steered the ship to safety at 2 a.m, I believe. And, you know, it's not easy being a woman in a man's field, but it's also just not easy being a second mate. You know, this is a very hierarchical society, and she tried to convince the captain to change course, but she could not. But yes, many terrific, compelling characters. I mean, remember, sailors, they're storytellers. And when you talked about kind of the informal banter that we caught on tape, I mean, hearing them tell their stories is just wonderful and moving, but also terrifying.
I thought it was also fascinating to read of the search and rescue effort undertaken by the Coast Guard, trying so hard more than anything else to help the families get some closure. And I'm sure that's made it even tougher on the families of the 33 who went down.
When you don't have a body, it's extremely difficult to have closure. And Deb Roberts is up there in Jay, Maine. Probably a lot of your listeners are familiar with her because she has taken her grief and turned it into action. She's working very hard to advocate for mariners out on the water now. Her son actually, I think, just is about to graduate from Maine Maritime. But yes, it's very, very difficult when you've lost somebody, but you never have that closure when you lose somebody at sea. It's true.
You talked to so many family members. How important was it for them to make sure the story was told accurately?
Well, that's exactly the thing, and I hope that I did. I mean, how the families feel about this book and the reception to the book is extremely important to me. I think when I reached out to the folks who did agree to talk to me, they understood that what I wanted to do was humanize this tragedy. We could say 33 mariners, but they were 33 lives. They were 33 families. There were children. There were mothers. There were fathers who lost people on board. And so I felt that this book was also a tribute to those incredibly strong families that let their children or their spouses go to sea. They were out of communication, you know, 3 months sometimes at a time. They let them go, and then they lost them.
I thought it was very interesting, too, because you have an image in your mind of sailors, mariners, and who they are today, but there is no one description because you have people on the El Faro of so many different backgrounds, levels of education, job descriptions. It really is a cross-section.
You know, that's what's so interesting about American shipping and actually global shipping is that, especially El Faro, I found it's really a microcosm of American society. You're absolutely right. People of all different educational levels, of all different, you know, socioeconomic levels, and from all up and down the East Coast. And they're all on this ship, which is out to sea. And so they only have each other. And it's just a really interesting society when you get on a working ship.
It seems hard to believe with all the technology that we have that a tragedy of this magnitude could happen. But the reality is that there are financial constraints, not just on companies and shipping companies, but on the government, on the National Transportation Safety Board as well. What have we learned from the sinking of the El Faro that might lessen the chance of something like this happening again?
Well, so the U.S. government, the federal government, spent millions of dollars first locating the ship because we could not find it 15,000 feet on the ocean floor. We had to actually first locate that ship, and then we had to recover the black box, which took more time. There was a two-year investigation, as you mentioned, jointly run by the National Transportation Safety Board and the Coast Guard. Out of those investigations and hearings came a series of recommendations. As you know, the wheels of law turn slow in America. Sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad, but it takes a long time for things to evolve and change in shipping. What I hope is that with this story, mariners and regulators and anybody involved with shipping can transform their thinking just a little bit to prevent something like this from happening again.
Rachel, you did a remarkable job in this, and I don't know that I can say this about many books, of evoking not just the feel, but the sound. I was struck by the sound that you're able to tell us about in words, from the sound of the storm to that awful sound of the ship hitting the bottom of the ocean. And it really helped put us there and get some kind of a feel for what it must have been like.
Well, I do love being on the water. I love sailing, and, you know, I've been in storms. I actually took a container ship from Italy to Baltimore, Maryland last summer. So I know ships a little bit. I've worked really hard to try to understand what it's like, of course, to be on a ship, but even in a storm. Now, I did my best. There are some incredible YouTube videos as well of ships in storms. Some of them I found out later actually cracked in half after the guys filmed those incredible moments of ships in storms. But thank you very much for the compliment. I mean, I did work very hard to try to be true to the mariners and their experience.
Well, and the story, too, that you relate about getting from, is it the pilot boat, the captain boat, up onto the ship, that was harrowing enough right there.
Yes, it was. I didn't quite know what I was getting in for there. So also to research the ship, this story, I had the privilege of riding piloting boats with Eric Bryson down in Florida. He was the last person on El Faro. He took El Faro from Jacksonville out to sea for her final run. So being able to do that exact run with the very same pilot was a powerful, powerful thing. And yes, I have to say, to board a ship at sea as a pilot, anybody who doesn't know this, please look it up because the YouTube videos are so harrowing. But this little boat pulls up alongside the ship, and a rope ladder comes down. When was the last time you had to climb a rope ladder? And then here, there's nothing below you. If you fall, you fall between the two vessels, you get sucked under, it's over. And plenty of pilots have died that way.
It is a remarkable book, Into the Raging Sea, 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of El Faro. Rachel Slade, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon.
Rich, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you.